Right, hello. And I'd just like to start by saying thank you for the invite to come over here. It's actually 24 hours door to door to get here from Bristol, but it's so nice to get here and find the sun shining. So, I'm talking about the impact of global warming on ecological networks. As an outline of what I'll be talking about, I'll start off by looking at interactions generally and global warming, going over what we know, looking specifically at three case studies. I'll then move on to one of the Bristol studies, looking at plant-pollinator interactions, and moving from looking at a food chain to a food web and the impact of global warming on entire networks of interacting species. And then I'll tell you specifically about the project I've done on global warming, looking at its impact on a 1,884 species plant-pollinator network, and wind up with just a brief mention of some future possibilities. So starting off with these three case studies, we know that an increase in mean global temperature is associated with an average advancement in phenology of life history events, so things like first flowering date and leaf flush. First study I want to tell you about is work done by Fitter and Fitter in 2001, published in Science, and they looked at first flowering date. Fitter and Fitter are a father and son team. Fitter Jr. is a professor at the University of York, and his father is a person who publishes field guides, and had this 50-year data set on first flowering dates of plants. And so we got the average first flowering date over 50 years. And what they found was that this first flowering date has moved forward by an average of 4.5 days during the last decade. At that time, that last decade was the 90s. So in comparison to the previous 50 years. So you can see here, we've got deviation of first flowering date, number of species, and you've got an average of 4.5. Notice it's on a distribution, though. That's important. I'll come back to that later. And if you're a food web ecologist like myself, you immediately start to think, well, what about the interactions with other species? You know, if the flowers are shifting, what's happening to the pollinators and the other things that feed on the flowers? So second study is looking at leaf flush. So another... So looking at leaf flush on the impact of plant-caterpillar-bird interactions, work done by Marcel Visser in the Netherlands. And we've got a three-species food chain here. We've got oak, we've got the winter moth, and the great tip. And they found that changes in leaf flush phenology have caused changes in caterpillar peak abundance. And the peak date of caterpillar food for the bird's offspring has advanced, and it's got a very narrow peak, this advance. But the great tits aren't laying their eggs any earlier, so you've got an asynchrony creeping in between the peak abundance of caterpillars and when those nestlings need the eggs. And then the third study is looking at the impact of frog pathogen interactions. This is looking at work by Alan Pounds, published in 2006 in Nature. And when I was a PhD student in Costa Rica, things like golden toads were on every postcard in every corner shop. They're extinct now. Similarly, harlequin frogs, this particular species shown in the picture, is now extinct. And there's actually an estimated 67% of the 110 species of harlequin frog are extinct. And what they think is going on is that temperatures of many of their sites are shifting towards growth optimums for outbreaks of a frog fungus. So you've got a change in the interactions due to global warming. So we've got phenology data in the change of these things like first flowering date and leaf flush. And we've got some interaction data, but it's concerning simple food chains only. So you've got your oak, your caterpillar, and your bird, or your beetles, your frogs, and your fungus. So these are food chains. And yet we all know, as ecologists, that interactions take place in the context of food webs. So this is actually a food web we're putting together for a farm in Wiltshire in England. And what I want to address today is the impact of global warming on these entire networks of interacting species. So moving on to some of the work we've been doing at Bristol on plant-pollinator interactions. So this is work I've carried out with Paul Craze, Mary Price and Nick Vassar. So myself and Nick Vassar and Mary Price are all field ecologists that work a lot on pollination, and Paul Craze is the guy we get to do our programming for us. So this is an interaction up here. We've got a vespid feeding on a figwort. And actually, just as an aside, I mean, as a pollination biologist, yeah, we refer to this as pollination. In reality, we really should call it visitation, because in a lot of these things, there isn't actually concrete evidence of pollination. It's assumed, but not proven. So this particular interaction took place in that plot there. So this plot is in an area called the Leawoods National Nature Reserve, which is on the outskirts of Bristol. If ever you visit Bristol, this is the iconic Clifton Suspension Bridge. I cycle across this every day, actually. It's really rather nice. And I had a plot in this woodland. There's an old Iron Age camp here. And I had a student working on that plot over the summer. And that was one of the interactions they spotted, that wasp on that flower. Now, what about the community context of this one single interaction? If we look at the network overall for that summer, it looks like that. So down the bottom here, we've got all of the plants. So this is a common flower, this is a rare flower. So all the plant species on the bottom. At the top here, we've got all the pollinators. They're color-coded so that if it's a Hymenoptera species, it's in red, light blue if it's a Diptera, dark blue is beetles and so on. And our one single interaction is here. So here's the wasp and here's the figwort. And you can see this is embedded in a complex network of interactions. And this is perfectly normal. This is just how the world is actually organized. Now, if this one species of plant here, if something changes with its phenology, that will actually affect the wasp and the other two species of insects that feed on that plant. Now, those three species of insect are connected to the rest of the network by the plants they actually feed on and pollinate, like that. So you can see that a change in one species has the potential to kind of ripple through the network and change all sorts of things. So species are connected both directly and indirectly. Now, this is actually a local web. This is what most of the work we do in my groups. We have these local webs that are replicated to answer some particular environmental question. So it's a snapshot over a single field season. For the work on global warming, we wanted to use a much bigger network. And so we pulled out our kind of heavyweight data set. And this is it's Robertson 1928. I refer to it as one of our golden oldies. I've got two of these very old data sets. And Charles Robertson worked here in the USA. In Illinois. And what he did for 10, 12 years of his life was he looked at the interactions between 456 plant species and 1,428 flower visiting species. And he published this as a self-published monograph. It's like a telephone directory full of Latin binomials. And in 2000, I got some funding to actually get this computerized so we could turn it into a network, basically. And it's a network of 15,000 odd unique interactions linking these plants to these insects. And there's a single species of hummingbird in there too. And we've done very well out of this data set. And Nick and I looked at the impact of alien plants on networks in 2002. Then Nick and Mary and I did some work on extinction dynamics in this network, asking what happens when you start killing species off one by one. When do you get like a cascade of extinctions? And we fancied basically a final fling with this network before going back to what we normally did. And we wanted to look at global warming for all the obvious reasons. So I'll take you through what the data set looks like and then explain what we did with it. So for the plants in this database, there's the first and last flowering dates over a 12-year period in the 1920s. And so basically you have the first over that 12-year period and the last. And so, for example, Aquilegia canadensis was first observed flowering on the 30th of April and last observed flowering on the 7th of May. So we got very good phenology data for all of the 456 plant species in that data set. For the pollinators, it's a bit messy, but you can still get some really good estimates. So what we have there are the first and last observation periods when Robertson watched each plant species that that particular insect species visited. So, for example, if we look at Bombylius major, we know this visited these three species of plants. Dicentra, it visited between the 9th of April and the 30th of April. Circis, between the 24th and the 5th of May. And then Hepatica, between the 27th of March and the 19th of April. So we can start to kind of bound its phenology. So if you combine the data from all of the plant groups, so here we've got the time of year along the bottom here, and I've just lined up the three species of plants. And so what you can actually say is that we know that that particular species of insect, that's its maximum activity period because it was seen on all those three species of plants. And then we can also bound its minimum activity period as well. So we come up with two estimates of this insect's phenology, a maximum estimate and a minimum estimate. And in actual fact, there were 39 observations for that particular insect. It was found visiting 39 different plant species. And so you can kind of bring all this data together, and for each of the pollinator species, you can come up with an estimate of its phenology. So in summary, we've got plant phenology data, we've got estimates of the maximum and minimum phenology for the pollinators, and these are linked into a network of 456 plants and 1,428 pollinators, linked by 15,000 odd unique interactions. The next stage is to actually simulate global warming on this network. So, predicting the size of these phenology shifts. We're talking about global average increases in temperature between 1.5 and 6.2 degrees C. We know from a variety of sources in the literature, we've got an average of 4 days advance per degree in flowering. So this is from Fitter and Fitter's data and a variety of others. If you just multiply those two together, you come up with an estimate that there's going to be phenology shifts of 7 to 21 days, 1 to 3 weeks basically, for flowering in plants. We also assigned 10% random phenologies for plants because there's evidence in the literature that some plants just do bizarre things. They behave rather randomly. So we put in 10% random phenologies. And then for want of better information, there's almost no data on what pollinators could do. We applied the same rules to those. So they were advancing again between 1 and 3 weeks. So there's lots of assumptions here. But remember that three of us are actually, you know, field biologists. So we're reasonably sensible. So, these shifts in phenology are actually drawn from a normal distribution with, for one of our models, a mean of 7 days, so this is the week shift, and a standard deviation equal to the mean. And again, this is coming from the literature. It's what Fitter and Fitter studies found. And what we're fitting is a distribution, okay, the same as Fitter and Fitter. So we've got a mean there, 7.7 days, but it could be a lot more than a mean. You know, it can be up to kind of 3 weeks, basically. We've got a large standard deviation here. Or it could be less. The plants could actually go the other way. And you're picking these shifts from this distribution, and we're using 1,000 iterations for each of our 1 week, 2 week, and 3 week shifts. So let's have a think about the possible outcomes. So we've got a very simple community there of four plants and a couple of pollinators connected by some interactions. What could happen is both the plants and the pollinators shift forward. But they're unlikely to shift by exactly the same amount because, remember, they've been picked from those distributions. So one could shift more than the other, leading to asynchronies. They could both shift back. Again, it's unlikely they'll shift by exactly the same amount. So you may get, again, asynchronies. Or they could shift in opposite directions, in which case you will definitely get some asynchronies between the pollinators and the flowers they visit. So what we did was run the simulations and count the number of pollinator species with one of three outcomes. Either no food, so all of the flowers have shifted out from underneath the kind of flight period of the pollinators. They're left with nothing to eat. We looked at gaps because gaps can be quite devastating. If you've got a gap of a week in the middle of a pollinator, a bumblebee nesting season, that'll kill it. They can't live for a week without food. And we also looked at curtailment of food sources, where the food supply is actually shortened, so they're actually available later in the season and they end sooner. Which again, for things like bumblebees that produce asexuals at the end of the season, can be fairly devastating. So we've got these three possible outcomes that we counted for each of our simulations. And this is what we found. Take you through this. This is the estimate, the results for the maximum estimate of pollination phenology. This is the proportion of pollinators up here that suffer some sort of disruption, so going up to one. And then these are our three advancements, 1 week, 2 week, and 3 week. And then these are the things we were counting, the numbers curtailed, the gaps and curtailed, and no food. So most, as you can see, are suffering from curtailment. The next most common thing is no food, which is in black down the bottom, and then the gaps. The gaps and curtailed together were actually so small that you can't see them on this figure. So that's the maximum estimate. If you look at the minimum estimate, you get the same general pattern, but slightly toned down. This makes sense. Basically, as disruption increases, the proportion of disruption increases as well. And what we did with this data was use it to kind of ring fence and come up with a ballpark estimate of the level of disruption to entire networks as a result of global warming. And so we took our lowest value and our highest value, and we found that between 17% and 50% of pollinators were affected in some way detrimentally by having no food, having gaps in their food, or having a shorter field season. So we've got some assumptions in there, as I said, but actually three of these assumptions will overestimate the detrimental effects, and three of them will actually underestimate the detrimental effects. And so we actually think it gives us a ballpark figure for the impact of global warming on a complete ecological network. And if you want to read more about it, the work was published last year. Right, so just coming on to future possibilities. This was the first go we had at doing this. One of the key things we need to do next is to actually incorporate behaviour into these models. Because at the moment, like most food, well, like all food webs, there's very little behaviour in there. We gave the pollinators no chance to actually swap to other plants. We figured that with a 12-year, very detailed data set, we'd got all the records of what they could eat. But we do badly need to put behaviour into food webs in general, and into pollination webs in particular. We also need to consider the impact of global warming on ecosystem services. Pollination is an ecosystem service. The other type of network we make widely in the lab are herbivore parasitoid networks. And again, those could be affected quite detrimentally by global warming as the herbivores respond to leaf flush, which is changing. So we need to know more about how ecosystem services will be affected. And we also need to consider the wider food web. That was just one tiny little bit of a food web from an ancient woodland. If I show you a larger food web, you'll get a better feel for this. The picture that's shown washed out behind there is actually one of our sites in the Azores. I've been working there the last 4 or 5 years, putting together a food web in some of the last remaining laurel forests in the Azores, which is a little archipelago, a third of the way between Portugal and the States. And this is our network from there. So this is work put together by Ruben Hilano, who's just about to submit his thesis. And what he did was link together a whole bunch of things. So he had seeds as the focus of his work. Seeds, as we all know, follow pollination. He had the herbivores that fed on the seeds, so the flies, the moths, the beetles, and so on. The parasitoids that fed on the herbivores that fed on the seeds. He had the seed dispersers and the seed predators, so he had the birds in there. And he even had the mites that were feeding on the birds that were feeding on the seeds in there. And we've got absolutely no idea what will happen to these types of networks if the phenology of seed production changes due to global warming. And we know that the phenology of flowering is changing, so it's very likely that phenology of seeding will be changing. We just don't know what's going to happen. So, take-home message. It's really worth thinking about the community-level impact of global warming, because all of ecology takes place in the context of these communities, and the effects can actually ricochet and cascade through networks. And then finally, as always, thanks to my research group who keep me sane and so interested in things, such as entertaining a tear shark to tea, and also to the University of Bristol and the British Ecological Society for funding the work. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions since our next presentation was canceled. So any questions for Jane or any of the other speakers who are all still here from this morning?
As you see the disruptions of pollinators acting on your plants with the shift in phenology, do you expect any impact on the spread of invasive species in the system as well?
So the question is, do I actually expect changes on the plant level as well as on the insect level by basal species?
Do you expect that there'll be shifts in the pollinator community towards being more invasive pollinators?
Possibly. I don't. There isn't a simple answer to that one. I mean, you're expecting changes. We've done lots of work on how alien species get into networks. So, and because they tend to be generalist, they do very well. So we know that it's easy to integrate into the networks anyway. So I don't actually know whether global warming will actually change that or not. We simply don't have the data. What we can start doing is actually putting novel species into networks. And we can also make use of, it's in silico, and we can make use of natural invasions, which is what we've done to date. Obviously, you can't start invasions. Well, you can actually. If you work with the biocontrol people, you can. But it's a tricky one to test in the field, but you can test it in silico and you can make use of natural invasions. But by and large, alien pollinators integrate very quickly and very effectively into native systems.
Phenology obviously changes geographically as well. Is that a similar phenomenon to this climate change?
I mean, what's going to happen? Ranges will come up and down. So we know, so one of the assumptions here is that, you know, our species could actually just move northwards or south. You know, they could actually follow, they could move into new environments. But ones from below could also move up into the network. So, it's, I mean, global warming is different to natural range invasions. I mean, the ranges will change. What would be nice, I mean, you will, you know, to actually have a transect of sites. It's something we are planning on doing up and down, say, the length of Great Britain, seeing how phenology actually influences network structure. Because by the time you get to the top of Scotland, you've got very depauperate communities compared to what you have down south. And it could be they're much more at risk from, you know, there's far less redundancy in those networks and so on.
In your analysis of the impacts of global warming, all the pollinators suffer. Didn't show any that benefited from a longer season. Is that, you think that's actually would not occur, or is that an indication of the way?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. It's asking actually if the species that benefit from this. We didn't measure that. Very possibly some will. But what you could do, I'm trying to think how you'd actually do that. You could actually make some assumptions about if an insect is feeding on a particular family of plants, that anything that actually shifts into that range that is in the same family can feed on. You're having to make decisions about what the pollinators will and won't feed on. Yeah, they'll be exposed to things they've not been exposed to before. That does come in under the actual introducing the whole, introducing behavior into the network. If you can do that, you can start to ask those sorts of questions.
First of all, I'm not an entomologist. I'm here with, as a guest with my daughter. But I've gotten interested in looking at agent-based simulations of environments and things like that. Is anybody working on looking at setting up some sort of simulations in almost like a game type of environment, looking using these rules for the agents to see what happens?
Oh, the answer to that is I don't know. What would be fun to put into these things, though, which actually does also come into the gaming thing, is to actually put evolution into there, so things can actually adapt and change over time. You're talking about kind of 100 years minimum before that'll happen. And again, we're thinking about doing that, but I don't know enough, as a field biologist, I don't know enough about the modelling side to answer your question properly, I'm afraid. Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, actually. One of my long-term plans is to put together a desert network, actually, for plants and pollinators. But yeah, in those sorts of systems, that is fairly... you could argue, that certainly with the work on the birds, there has been an evolutionary response. So birds that actually get it right have a huge advantage in life because, you know, they hit the peak and their offspring survive. So depending on how much variation there is in when the bees do actually emerge, you know, it could solve itself. But it's certainly... in those sorts of really hostile environments, it's going to get interesting. Yeah, we made the assumption that the insects would, you know, respond on the same distribution. That's simply for want of there's just no information. That, you know, they may work on the same sorts of cues, but equally they may not. And in that case, it certainly sounds like they're not. Okay.
Any other questions for Jane? Okay, let's thank her once again. Great.